Brigadier Calvert, Trail 21.
We went forward after the 72 hours had elapsed when the Canadians had said they would overrun the French, and we overran. Oh, damn. Well, after the 72 hours, which the Canadians had said they would overrun the French, had elapsed, and there was not much sign of them, we went forward in our staff car and overran a number of the French and got first-hand information from them. Now, I've written about this in a number of times and in a magazine which I have given to Mr. Conrad Wood. Yes. And so I won't go into too much of the details. Suffice it to say that it was Assen under Colonel Balladier where the greatest amount of fighting took place. We also had taken over at least one airfield which was of value. Strangely enough, although it was fairly open country with a certain amount of trees, it was due to the fact that it was cut up by canals that the Germans couldn't get at the French SAS who were operating in a guerrilla fashion, because the Germans by this time had become road-bound in lorries, and they couldn't cross the canals when they wanted to, and they could be shot up in so doing. So, strangely enough, I had read from Marshal de Saxe's memoirs, I think they're on war, or musings, I think they were musings on war, that in the 17th century, he had been operating in Holland. One of the greatest generals of all time, fought 365 battles. And he said, these guerrillas in Holland, or whatever it was called then, are a terrible nuisance. I even had all my baggage captured by them in the area of Assen. And I remembered this because if guerrillas could operate hundreds of years ago, I felt we could operate as well. Finally, the armored cars of the Canadians followed up after my frantic messages, but we went on ahead and I joined up with the Belgian SAS, and we overran a number of the French SAS positions until we reached the outskirts of Winschoten, Winschoten. There, company of German parachute regiments had entrenched themselves, and I wanted to take that so as we could reach the North Sea. The Belgians had 16 armored jeeps, which is five Vickers machine guns between them, and we had good close air support. I asked the Canadian Air Force to bomb Winschoten, indicating the targets necessary, and then to do some dummy runs whilst we advanced, and also put down smoke. I also got the... Now, as you were, I didn't... they didn't put down smoke, to do some dummy runs. I also got the Polish battery to put down 100 rounds rapid, and then to put down smoke. The order to put down smoke surprised them because they weren't ready for it. Evidently, it hadn't been used so much, I don't know. And the smoke they put down consisted of all colours, which confused the Germans even more. Under the cover of smoke, the Belgians attacked along this road, which was on high embankment. And fortunately, there was just a turn before it reached Winschoten, so that all the jeeps could enfilade Winschoten as they drove in without firing on each other. They went in firing in all directions, and with this sudden blitz, the German parachute regiment surrendered and it took the place. Later, the Canadian armoured cars came up, and I think they possibly claimed that they'd taken Winschoten. I'd come across Colonel Bouladier, and we went around collecting his men, some of whom wouldn't stop. This attacking spirit of the French was so great that they wanted to go on fighting. And some of them had even captured German armoured cars or tanks and were saying that they were going to go to Berlin. And this is the great attacking spirit of the French. They had all those adjectives in the French language which we haven't got words to express, like élan and a few of the other ones to describe themselves. And I have the utmost admiration for their fighting spirit at that time of the war. The Belgians motored on to Emden, and with very few casualties indeed. But when one little sideline, when I was working in the jeeps with Colonel de Bouladier, we just had two jeeps with us, we crossed the German frontier by mistake through bad map reading. In that area, it's a lot of forestation, and all the roads are at right angles to each other, so it's very difficult to tell on which road you're at. And as we went round along one road, suddenly we were confronted by some Germans, elderly Germans in uniform, who promptly surrendered. And we found we had liberated a prisoner of war camp of about 6,000 Polish girls who had been captured in Warsaw. I will say their condition looked perfectly all right.
These were civilian girls?
Yes. We were, when we came in, we were surrounded by these girls and carried shoulder high all round the camp, and they ripped from our uniforms all sorts of souvenirs, practically all our buttons are souvenirs. So when we went out, we were pretty bedraggled. We insisted that there was a Polish division nearby, and we motored back to the Polish division, and we told them that these girls' camp was there, and they rushed off and wanted to shoot all the wardens, or whatever you call people who look after a camp. But the Polish girls said that a lot of the wardens had been very kind to them and looked after them, but there was one or two, and they just pointed out to one or two men or women who had behaved very badly, and they were shot, but the rest were looked after. The only snag about it was there was a sort of bend in the Allied line from that time onwards as the Poles met the girls, and this put a halt to the advance of the Polish division. I'd like to just draw some things from that, some lessons from that operation. One was the quick reaction of the SAS, and if you have young men who are young officers and NCOs who are used to taking command and facing decisions, and it's amazing what you can do. You don't have to issue orders in detail. There are very few written orders. You just tell them what the general job is, and they get on with it. I do want to impress on everybody how good the French are as in attack. They really were amazing. I had a very good staff. Esmond Baring, of the Baring banking family, was my G1, and he was absolutely invaluable in holding everything together and translating my orders into what you might call British Army of the Rhine language, or BLA, Britain Liberating Army language. Pat Hart was my quartermaster, and he could get things at the drop of a hat. There was only one rather sad thing which happened. It was when Prendergast tried to get the jeeps dropped, and to this day the French are indignant about not having their jeeps. The RAF refused to drop them, and the answer was that they're afraid they might drop them in the wrong place, or they didn't know what the anti-aircraft situation was, and a few all sorts of minor details like that. And I've got to say, Prendergast, although he was a fairly strong-minded chap, he hadn't got his heart in this operation, possibly because I had gone over his head and was commanding the French direct myself. And he didn't press strongly enough to get the jeeps dropped. I personally, on this question of going over his head, I didn't quite know. I took command, I had to get everybody into action very quickly. I didn't quite know what the French liaison unit was. They kept themselves hidden from me until, and so I didn't really use them very much. There were some very brave men amongst them, the Englishmen amongst them, and they did bring some jeeps over from Essex, and they later got them to the French, some of them to the French, as the little campaign went on. But I think Prendergast tried to avoid me. I think he was a great disappointed. He hoped that he would take over the SAS. And he was a very articulate person in writing, but he bore a brunt against me from then on. But it's just a question of two different personalities with different military upbringings. Well, that is all on that operation of the war. I would like to make just what happened after that. We regathered everybody, and then the VE Day was approaching, and I was consulted as to whether the SAS could be used in Holland. The situation in Norway was that there was about 300,000 Germans in Norway of low category, also about 300,000 or 400,000 Russians, ex-prisoners, or prisoners of war there. The Norwegian forces were divided into three, both in fact and politically and almost in thought. There was the ones who had mostly naval and merchant navy who had escaped over to England and were of enormous value to Britain in the 4 million tons of shipping they brought with them. And they, of course, were headed by King Haakon and the royal family. A second lot, as the Germans approached, they either fled or escaped later on into Sweden, and Sweden reformed them into units with the object of them occupying Norway to keep the peace until such time as a new government was formed. And so they were trained to believe that they'd take over. There's a third lot, which were the resistance movement, which only a few of them had fought very hard and done very well. The others hadn't been, I forget the name of the word, hadn't been activated. And yet they thought that they should run the country. There was a tendency, of course, as with all resistance movements, for them to be impregnated with communist ideas. So King Haakon was very eager that British forces should take over Norway, disarm the Germans, send back the Russians, and to hold the area until such time as they could have an election and their own government take over. So it was decided that 1st Airborne under General Urquhart and the SAS under me should be flown in. Now, I want to give another example of the ubiquitousness and the initiative of the SAS and the capability of using that with good signals backing. The SAS were now, as V-Day approached, were divided up right across Europe from Italy to the North Sea. I decided that the Belgians should be used with Second Army, who wanted to use them to round up war criminals, because they were, most of them could speak about three or four different languages. And so they worked with Second Army, the Army Group, and amongst other people they captured was Goering. They didn't know what to say, so they used to say, we've taken you on orders of General Calvert. So my name got involved in that, but of course I was nowhere near them. The French were brought back to Britain and reorganized, and later I flew down from Norway, and we had a magnificent return of the French at Po to the French army. And I got permission through both the King and Charles de Gaulle. It had to be agreed to before we announced it, before we offered it, that the French SAS should be allowed to continue to wear the red beret. And so they were joined the French army, and they were used part of the time to stop smuggling from in the Pyrenees from across from Spain, and then also to be a parachute unit, and they formed the beginnings of the French airborne forces. The Belgians later on, when they'd done their job, were returned to Belgium rather dramatically. We did a parachute drop on the field of Waterloo, where about 300,000 Belgians were watching, and they returned to the arms of the Belgians. Colonel Blondeel was offered the job of Minister of Defence. I'm not certain whether he took it or whether he only took it for a short time, but he said, now the answer to training is for all troops to be made parachutists, because the very fact of parachuting would prove their manhood, would prove their physical attributes, and prove their courage. And it is a point worth considering, where the parachuting isn't its greatest attribute is a form of training, moral training. Now for the operations in Norway, I sent out a signal to all forces, all British forces in Europe, to rendezvous at a town, I can't remember its name, near Zeebrugge or something like that. Oh, near Ostend, that's right. And arranged for some I think they were landing craft or something like that, to bring them back to Essex. So they all came back, found their way back. This is what I say about a force like the SAS. You just have to tell them to do something. They know where to pick up food and do this, that, and the other, and petrol. And they came across without any paperwork at all. Arrived in Colchester. By this time, their quartermasters had got all their new suits ready and pressed, and equipment all beautiful, the pay books brought up to date, and everything of that nature. And they arrived back in Essex, changed into their new uniform, looked smart and spruce, and within 2 days were flown, or some of them were flown over to Stavanger. Actual fact, there was a pause. I went across to Stavanger where the 1st Airborne had landed, and also they'd landed in Oslo. But there was some dreadful weather, and quite a lot of aircraft were crashed in the snowstorms, so that the SAS were delayed. I had 5 officers and 17 men and set out to Kristiansand. My first job was as zone commander in Kristiansand. There I came across 25 snorkel submarines, of which the Royal Navy didn't even know were in existence, so some of them. The weather had closed down, and I had to act on a job which I hadn't been taught. The German army surrendered very quickly, and I marched around with the German commander, and if anybody didn't salute me, or this, that, and the other, I told the German to put him under arrest and put him in order. I spent my day marching around the town. I had one sapper officer with one or two sappers. I told him to man a gun overlooking the harbour and to fire a gun off. I said, you better learn how to do it. He fired one or two shots across the bay just to show they had manned. I went down to there was a Air Force Luftwaffe party, which was mainly experimental. They were very languid, I should say, and were reluctant to surrender to an army officer. but I had an Air Force officer with me, and they surrendered to him. The German submariners, what do they call themselves? Subboaten or something. They were very truculent. They lounged about in a pair of slips with their hats on, sunbathing, and they wouldn't get up. They just stayed there. And I had to put German soldiers on guard, and I also had a British guard there. This is out of 17 men. Their sole job was to count the submarines. Well, one submarine got away, and he may have been laid some mines on the route, because when the Navy did come in, they struck two mines and the ship sunk. And on what they thought was a swept channel, this submarine travelled underwater, which they said was the longest underwater travel to that date, and they eventually reached Argentine. The captain of that submarine has written a book and describes the whole thing. Now, it's on that submarine that all the rumours go that various high-up Germans escaped to the Argentine in that way. As far as I know, they may or may not have done. We had no difficulty to imagine what, with five officers and 17 men, they couldn't do very much. Well, the weather cleared, eventually got the whole of the SAS across, and I think we did it so well. We put the Germans onto clearing mines off the beaches, and that we were sort of promoted and went to Bergen, take over Bergen Zone, which is a very much bigger area. And Bergen, of course, was the second biggest town in Norway. It is also the most sort of truculent town, because it was on the west coast. They were a different type of person, and they were sort of rivals of Oslo. And it rather suited the Bergenese and Western people, I guess, to have a different sort of unit looking after them. I ought to have mentioned that the general, the GOC, British general, was an old friend of mine, was General Bulgy Thorne, who of the Grenadier Guards. He had been the military attaché in Berlin until just before the war, and he was in command in Kent and Sussex for the invasion, and it was under him that Peter Fleming and myself worked to raise the guerrilla defence of Great Britain, the guerrilla defence of Kent and Sussex. And he's a very likeable chap, and he was very good to me, and he liked me. I have quite a lot more to say about Norway, and I think perhaps I ought to stop there.